Stand, please.
Oyez, oyez, oyez. All persons having business before the Honorable United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this honorable court. Be seated, please. Case number 09-3099, United States of America versus Mark Stubblefield, appellant. Mr. Hart for appellant, Mr. Friedman for appellee.
Good morning. It pleases the court. My name is Dennis Hart. I'm here today on behalf of Mark Stubblefield, who was convicted of robbing or attempting to rob seven banks. I assume the audience is here for the second case because they all do look like bankers.
Maybe they're the customers.
And I say that because I want to remind the court that this is an identification case and looks can be deceiving. We raised three issues in our brief. Because we did not file a reply brief, I'd like to take the next 9-7 minutes to just touch on some of the government's arguments and indicate to the court our response to them. The first issue that Mr. Stubblefield raised was limitations based on a closing argument. The government moved and the trial court agreed to limit defense counsel from arguing the concept or the argument that DNA evidence and fingerprint evidence are more reliable than eyewitness testimony. And second, the second issue was an issue of best practices for photo identification. The government says that trial court was correct in this because there was no evidence of that. I'm forced to agree with most of that. But I don't believe that ends the issue. This is an argument. It's not evidence. It is within common public knowledge or common human experience to the degree that trial counsel should be permitted to argue that. What we disagree with in the government's response in this issue, this area, is that the government concludes its argument on the closing restrictions with the statement that there is overwhelming evidence in this case, and relying on Kodiakos says, even if there was error, it did not affect the result. And we strenuously disagree with that. The government is tempted to rely on the district court too much in this conclusion, where the district court did say it was overwhelming case against Mr. Stubblefield. We suggest the district court has a dog in that fight, and it's not necessarily independent judgment when the district court says there's overwhelming evidence. And we urge this court to take an independent view of the evidence before agreeing with the government's conclusion. Well, there was so much evidence here, any error doesn't matter.
You were allowed during closing to argue that there was no lineup, there was no physical evidence or forensic evidence, that the photos array was not reliable, the IDs were not reliable. You made a number of arguments attempting to undermine the validity of the photo array, attacking the lack of physical evidence. Very strong argument.
I agree, trial counsel did. She did a very good job, but the fact is, whether Mr. Stubblefield was given a fair trial is not whether she did the best with what she was given, but whether she was given what she deserved to work with in the closing. So that's sort of a red herring, and it goes into the argument of how strong the evidence was. The government is allowed, of course, to pick and choose its evidence.
There's no requirement that you have DNA evidence or fingerprint evidence.
Certainly not.
And this best practices argument seems a little unusual.
I don't think so, Your Honor, because if the court, this was a long, complicated trial, and if the court reviews all of the testimony, particularly of the agents who showed the photographs, it will learn that there were two different agencies involved, the FBI and Metropolitan Police. They both had different techniques, and they both explained those techniques to the jury.
Well,
But was there evidence introduced about what the best practices were?
No, there was not direct evidence.
The basis for the district court's decision, right?
Well, the district...
There was a debate about, among the witnesses, correct, about the best procedures that they knew of, but there was no evidence introduced about what the best practices were.
Your Honor is correct.
And that was the basis for the court's... And isn't that decision correct?
We disagree, Your Honor, because it, in effect, turns the trial into a scientific inquiry that need not be had, because it is our belief that it is a common human practice within the common human experience to know that there's a best way to do something, whether you're fixing a car or treating a patient or doing anything. And best practices is not such a term that...
How would that apply to photo arrays? I mean, it's fairly technical about how these photo arrays are constructed and the procedures following them. I doubt that the TV watching public really knows the best way to do that.
Unless they watch CSI a lot.
Yeah.
Your Honor's answered my question.
Do you think CSI is proof of what the best practices are?
No. I think it is proof that criminal procedures employed in investigating crimes are within the common human experience.
What about jurors who don't watch those shows?
It would be hard to find a juror who doesn't.
I don't watch them. I know a lot of people.
In the closing, the government referred to the CSI.
Yes. And in other courts, the government is given an instruction about, for instance, DNA, that they're not required
to. The government was worried the lack of physical evidence here, forensic evidence, would convince the jurors who watch CSI not to convict.
Yes.
So they actually fronted that issue in the closing.
Yes, and I think it reflects the fact that jurors are aware of what best practice for forensic investigations are.
I thought, Mr. Hart, that you might, of your two principal substantive arguments, that your 404B argument is the stronger.
Then I'd be happy to go to it right now.
Right.
We agree that... the trial court did give a bad character, this is not bad character, don't consider it for other things, instruction. The government thinks that cures the problem. We suggest it does not cure the problem. The Bank of America robbery was an eighth robbery that occurred in Virginia, was not charged. The government concludes that, the government's theory, I believe, is that similar circumstances, similar characteristics, and I believe it relies on two cases.
Yeah, how do you distinguish those two cases?
They use Lawson and Levy,
right.
Levi.
Yeah.
In Lawson, the court, which allowed the 404B evidence of other robbery, the government says that the circumstances are the same, that the similarities were the same between Mr. Stubblefield's case and Mr. Lawson's case. We believe they are not. For instance, in Lawson, the court will find that it was one robbery in which a 404 robbery of another bank was allowed in, but in both cases they had two men involved, a tall man and a short man, who both robbed in the same manner. I believe the tall man had an unusual gun that he used in both robberies, a silver hammered shotgun, as I recall.
Handgun.
And that the tall man, or perhaps the short man, had particular clothing, I'd say striped...
Right, but I understand, obviously, the defendant in this case and the defendants in those cases had different physical characteristics, but, how do you distinguish the reasoning in that case from this case?
Because the similarities are nowhere near close. I mean, if you list the...
Because there was no silver gun?
No, I'm sorry. I misspoke if that's what I implied. What I implied is if you add up the similarities in Lawson, you get to a total of five or six similarities between the robberies. You don't get to that number anywhere near close in Mr. Stubblefield's case. Short black man is the best they can do as a common denominator.
What about the voice?
Well, the voice is interesting. Some said it was...
What about this?
Smoker's voice. Some said it was husky voice. Some said it was a female voice. Now, how you can get a common denominator out of that, I don't understand. The Levy case is the same situation, although the court, I believe there, it was a severance issue. And I think the court in passing said, well, they could have introduced the other robbery in the case anyway. But if you add up, once again, the similarities in Levy, I get a total of four, that they were similar notes, that they were similar clothes, and they robbed the bank in the same general area. Now, I wrote that down because I think that's important in this case. In Levy, the court said, well, the government can introduce this other robbery because it occurred in the same general area. That's one of the distinguishing characteristics of the Bank of America. It occurred in another jurisdiction. Using Levy, that should disqualify it. We suggest that no matter what the government says is similar, if the court were to look at the similarities for the six robberies and one attempted robbery, and then look at the similarities in Bank of America, they'll find a great deal of dissimilarity. Now, as I said, the government can pick its evidence to make a case for a strong case, but they can't pick their evidence for the similarity, and the court has to look at the entire record.
Before you run out of time, can I ask you about your Speedy Trial Act claim? So you agree that they need one more day, is that right? Just one more day?
I brought my calendar.
Yeah, so do I. I have mine too. It's all, just one more day, right?
I agree.
All right, so can we focus on just one of their many arguments, which is the May 23rd continued detention hearing?
Yes, sir.
Why isn't that the one more day? Why isn't that either an other proceeding under H1 or a motion, pretrial motion, through the conclusion of the motion under H1D, or both? That is, on that day, according to the docket, an oral motion for detention was made, and the district court, at the end of the detention hearing, granted it. So for that reason, it would seem to fall under D. And at the same time, it is another proceeding other than the trial, and therefore would fall under H1. And since all they need is one day, and as a general matter, when there's a proceeding on a day, they get the whole day, why doesn't that resolve the issue?
If the district court had told us that, I wouldn't be here.
Well, that's not... Oh, you wouldn't be
why?
Here because you agree with that?
I do.
You do. Okay. So the only question is whether there is another ground upon which to affirm the district court. Right. Now, we've had other cases where we've said that the fact that the court gave several grounds but not the ground that the appellate court relied on, that was good enough. You agree this is good enough then?
Yes, and I should say I wouldn't be here for that issue.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Michael Friedman, and I represent the United States. Your Honors, the trial court properly exercised its discretion when it precluded two and only two arguments from Appellant Stubblefield's closing. The first argument is that there was such a thing as a quote-unquote best practice for conducting photo array procedures, and two, that certain types of forensic evidence were quote-unquote better than others. It was proper to preclude these two arguments for the reasons that the trial court stated, because there was no evidence for supporting either of those propositions. With respect to this idea of a best practices, defense counsel asked government witnesses on several different occasions whether they were aware of any best practices for conducting these photo array procedures. And the witnesses answered no, they were not aware of any best practices. There was no follow-up by defense counsel. There was never any best practice introduced into evidence. Defense counsel didn't say, well, isn't it a best practice to do this or to do that? The only evidence on the point is in the negative. There simply was no evidence of it. And the same is true with respect to the idea that certain types of forensic evidence are better or more reliable than others. The evidence in this case certainly supported that there was no DNA evidence. Government witnesses were asked, did you search for DNA evidence? Did you find any? And the answer was no. And defense counsel argued in closing that there was no DNA evidence, and that was something that the jury can and should have considered.
Mr. Friedman, could I switch your attention to the question I find more difficult, which is the 404B question? So in order to get under this particular pigeonhole that you're looking for, it has to be similar. You're looking for identity, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
That's the hole that you have to get in. So it has to be quite similar. Whether it has to be totally signature or not is a question, but it has to be very similar. And in the Lawson case, there were three unique items. One, a what was we described as an unusual silver hammered handgun. That is something that was not seen very often. Second, sort of a Mutt and Jeff, a short robber, a tall robber, the short robber having striped pants, the tall robber being in a set of clothes, where they were both seen the same way in both cases. What degree of similarity do you have in this case that approaches that degree of similarity?
Your Honor, there were several things. One of them was the distinctive physical appearance of appellant's double field. One thing described by witnesses was the appellant's height. He was described unanimously as short, and in fact as being very short. Some referred to him as a 4 foot 11 inch, 5 foot one. There was a range of descriptions in the testimony, but what was unanimous is that he was quite short.
But in the, what was the description in the 404 by the 404B witness? That's really what matters here. What was that description?
Well, she describes him as being short.
Yeah, but there are a lot of short people in the world, and she didn't describe him as incredibly short, midget short, any kind of short like that. So all we have is that you have a short man. What's your next argument?
The next thing was the nature of his voice.
Raspy.
Right. I think the witness from the Virginia robbery described him as having the voice of like people smoking a lot. It was a hoarse, raspy voice. And that was something distinctive. It was distinctive enough that it stood out to the witness, such that she reported it to law enforcement and then testified to it. Both of these things, the height and the voice, were distinctive enough that they warranted a comment on the part of the eyewitness. A third was the small, torn note that the bank robber provided. This was something that was similar amongst all of the robberies.
It's not really unusual for bank robbers to provide notes, is it?
It's not unusual, but a small, torn note was a distinctive piece of evidence.
How small was the note?
It was described as small, and it was...
Well...
And it was also, and it was...
Doesn't strike me as terribly. I've seen CSI, you know, I watch television. They always use notes, and they're usually small. They don't come in with poster boards. That can't really be enough.
Well, there was an additional distinctive thing about this note, which is that it appeared to be torn or crumpled up, and that was something that was shared amongst all of the bank robbers.
The physical appearance part, which seems to me the strongest possible argument, she didn't make that. She didn't say that in the Virginia case, did she?
I'm not sure I follow your question.
The thing about his face being the scarred face, that aspect, did the 404B witness refer to that?
No.
So the what is really the most distinctive thing about him, that is the thing that most of the other witnesses referred to, she didn't refer to.
That is one distinctive thing that she did not refer to. But the other, of course, quite distinctive thing about this case is that the witness from the Bank of America identified appellant as the bank robber during a subsequent photo array.
That, I think you're mixing up two different parts of this argument. It can't be that because we know he robbed a bank in Virginia, that's evidence that he robbed all the other banks. That's pure propensity, right? And that's exactly what the rule forbids. The identity issue, you do have to show that he's the guy who robbed the bank in Virginia, but that's a separate question from whether the similarities between the person who robbed the bank in Virginia and the other banks come within 404B, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that's right.
Because if you could show, if you had a picture of him robbing each of these banks, you wouldn't need 404B, right? You would have the evidence that he robbed the banks. Similarly, I'm concerned about the district court's discussion of the 404B. The district court said, well, we allow lots of drug case evidence in under 404B. That is, if you possess with intent to distribute last year, that evidence can come in as 404B this year. But my recollection is that all of those cases come in under the intent element, not under the identity element. Isn't that right?
Your Honor, that may be true. The court didn't further explain which cases it was exactly referring to here. But what is clear from this court's case law, and this is from the Lawson case and others, is that the similarities, the uncharged bad act and the charged conduct need to be similar. They don't need to be identical. And the Lawson case is a good example of this. In one of the bank robberies in Lawson, the perpetrators wore masks. And in another, they did not wear a mask. And that was, you know, something of an important difference between the identity of the people. And so, and there are certainly some differences in this case as well. But what matters is not that the crimes be identical. This is not a modus operandi case where the identity is being proven by some sort of a trademark or signature crime.
What is identity if it's not modus operandi? Isn't that the point of the identity section? Whether it has to be perfectly perfect signature, what else can come under the identity pigeonhole other than modus operandi?
All sorts of things. The physical appearance, and this is what the court talked about in the Lawson case, the physical appearance, the behavior of the person.
Isn't behavior modus operandi?
Yeah, I
get your point on physical appearance. You're right about that, obviously.
Right. I think my point was that this is not a case which is being proved through the use of a trademark act or a signature type of act, the way that some cases when there is no physical description. This is not like those cases. This is a case where the physical characteristics and the conduct of the person as evidenced by the testimony, that's what establishes the similarities. And in any event here, Your Honors, we did make a harmlessness argument that even if the court were to find that the trial court abused its discretion in conducting the balancing inquiry here, this was a long trial. It was a three weeks of testimony, and the government presented dozens of witnesses. Only one witness was the bank robber. Late in the trial, one witness testified about the Virginia robbery, and we think that given the totality of all that was presented at trial, there's no reason to believe.
It was a closed case, though. So normally when you're making a harmless error argument on something like that, it's some kind of overwhelming case. This strikes me, and it's hard to make this assessment just from the paper, but as being a very close case.
Well, Your Honor, the government here presented testimony from six separate people who witnessed these bank robberies.
Right, some of whom didn't identify the defendant in the photo array, and actually one of whom said that's not the guy.
That's right. There was one, but there were six. Each of the bank robberies had at least one eyewitness who positively identified Appellant Stubblefield from a photo array as the bank robber. Several of the robberies had two witnesses who positively identified. And the government also presented the testimony of numerous other witnesses who testified as to what they saw. On top of that, there was testimony from a woman named Bernice Stewart who testified that she knew Appellant Stubblefield they had a 35-year relationship, and she looked at some of the surveillance footage from the banks and testified that after looking at the surveillance footage, she knew that was Mark Stubblefield based upon the way he looked and her.
Well, you couldn't see him on the surveillance photos, though, right? Wasn't it all grainy and you couldn't tell that it was him on the surveillance?
You could see him. You couldn't make a positive facial identification. It wasn't that clear of a photo, but you could see a lot of characteristics, Your Honor.
Can I ask you, I just want to ask one question about the Speedy Trial Act, although in light of what Mr. Hart said and my question, I guess there may not be that much more to it. You were stressing the May 13th to May 16th period, right?
Well, that's one of the periods that we discussed, Your Honor.
It seemed to me that there was nothing, at least there's no evidence that there was anything pending during that period. That is, the district court, according to the district court's docket, I mean the magistrate's docket, the AUSA filed an oral motion for what we used to call a three-day hold, and the district court and the magistrate granted the three-day hold, and then set a detention hearing, which is what happens at the end of a three-day hold. So there was nothing pending during that period. I'm having a little difficulty understanding why that period of time would be excludable.
Your Honor, our argument was that the entire period from May 13th through May 23rd is excludable.
Right, but he didn't, at least the prior practice was that at the preliminary hearing, if you wanted a detention hearing, you asked for a three-day hold. You didn't ask for permanent detention at that point. You asked for a hold. And that's all that the docket reflects. It doesn't, I think you would have an argument if at the preliminary hearing the AUSA said, Your Honor, we're asking to hold this person pending trial. And then you might have an argument all the way until the detention hearing. But according to the docket, the oral motion was not for that. It was for a temporary detention, which is the three-day hold, which the court granted. So do you have any evidence that the AUSA actually asked for pretrial detention as compared to the hold? I mean, one of the things that was said later was there was an issue about whether there was an outstanding warrant, and they wanted to find out about that. That would obviously make a difference as to whether there would be detention. Is there any evidence in the record that the request was for detention?
Well, Your Honor, if I can respond in two ways. The first is that we agreed that I actually believe that the period from May 16th and onward is the stronger period for our argument. But with respect to the initial period, there was at least an argument that when the government requests the detention hearing, what that request encompasses is a request for pretrial detention, and that request didn't get resolved in this case until May 23rd. Now, I agree the docket in this case indicates that the motion for the temporary three-day hold was granted. But I think there's at least an argument, and this is why we cite a series of cases in our brief decided by other circuits indicating that the time period from the request for a detention hearing is excludable. But I think the circuit has not decided that question. But I think there is at least an argument that the request for a detention hearing encompassed within that is a request for detention.
Because the district court's, the docket, again, the magistrate court's docket doesn't refer to a motion for detention until May 23rd, right? The docket is actually very clear and very detailed, and it says, oral motion by USA to commit defendant to custody of the Attorney General. That's not made until May 23rd.
Well, Your Honor, there was a hearing on May 16th, a detention hearing.
Right.
And at the conclusion of it, and the transcripts reveal the court was aware that it was time for it to make a decision on a request for detention. And what happened is that defense counsel urged the court not to make the decision yet because defense counsel wanted to investigate whether there was an outstanding warrant in another jurisdiction. So at defense counsel's request, the court held off on making a decision on detention. So I think when considering the transcript from the May 16th hearing, it's clear that at least as of May 16th, a request for detention was pending at that time.
Although the court on May 16th says that the United States had made a request for a detention hearing, not a request for detention. Doesn't say detention. The district court didn't say detention.
Right. Well, the court also added, and I have the transcripts here, but they're at counsel's table next to me. The court also added that it has not yet made a final determination on detention.
That's great. Okay, thank you.
Your Honor, we ask the court to affirm the judgments. Thank you.
Mr. Hart, I think you've used up your time, but you can take 2 more minutes if you'd like.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Yeah. Sure.
And if I can hit three bullet points. Number one, the surveillance photos were never identified by any bank witness as being Mr. Stubblefield at trial. The only one who identified the bank surveillance photos was his disgruntled girlfriend. Number two, I don't recall any distinct testimony about the note in the Bank of America case, whether it's small or crumpled or torn, that would connect it, as the government now claims, with the notes in the District of Columbia cases. Finally, the comparison for 404B purposes cannot be limited to just what the government put in its direct case. Please look at the defense case, because the defense, in any bank robbery I've ever had, has never done this. They've put on witnesses from the victim banks who said this wasn't the guy. My notes here indicate that the Bank of America witnesses, at least three of them, not called by the government but called by the defense, said the person was Hispanic, 5'6". The second witness said he was 20 to 25 years old, 5'6". Third witness said he was in his 20s and he was 5'8". If the government picks and chooses, they can convince this court that the bank robberies are similar. But if the court looks at all of the evidence, it has to reach the conclusion that there was no similarities and that the 404B decision to admit it was an error. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Hart, you were appointed by the court to represent Mr. Stubblefield. You've done a fine and thorough job, and we're grateful to you for your assistance. Thank you.
Thank you.